The Guardian. Politics Weekly with Nick Watt.
Hello, I'm Nick Watt and welcome to Politics Weekly. Well, there was a nostalgic feel in the air at Westminster this week when MPs from all the main parties rebelled against their leaders over that favourite old chestnut, Europe. The biggest casualty of the day was Nick Clegg, the new leader of the Liberal Democrats. He lost three members of his shadow cabinet after they voted in favour of a referendum on the new EU treaty in defiance of his demand that Lib Dem MPs should not vote at all. Clegg, who would rather have a wider in-or-out referendum on Britain's membership of the EU, found himself remorselessly taunted.
He attacked the government for dismissing all calls for a referendum, as it then was, and playing straight into the hands of the Eurosceptics. He said, "Nothing will do more damage to the pro-European movement than giving room to the suspicion that we have something to hide, that we do not have the cojones to carry our argument to the people." Now, it may be an explanation, Sir Alan, of why the Liberal Democrat leadership's protests over the course of these debates have become ever more shrill, that at some point... at some point in recent months, they have become separated from their cojones.
Yes, that was William Hague mocking Nick Clegg on Wednesday. We'll be asking whether the Lib Dem leader is damaged goods and whether Britain will ever enjoy a stable relationship within the EU. Joining me to discuss these matters are three giants from the Westminster and media world. Flying the blue and yellow flag of the European Union is the former Home Secretary Charles Clarke. Charles is widely seen as one of the most pro-European cabinet ministers of recent years. We also have The Guardian columnist Jenny Russell and Martin Kettle. A quick question for the three of you. Is Nick Clegg damaged by that frontbench rebellion? Charles?
Definitely is. I think that the art of political leadership for any party, including the Liberal Democrats, is to have a clear line and carry it through. The Liberal Democrats have always classically been a party in favour of strengthening the European Union for a lot of reasons, many of which I agree with. This was an opportunity. This treaty is an opportunity to do that. And they should have been very clear about it. They decided to confuse themselves about the referendum relationship in relation to it in a way that led to a rather chaotic situation. Nick has nobody to blame other than himself, in my opinion.
Jenny?
I'm sorry to say, this just confirmed what I always feared, is that he's not the person who can do the job. And I doubt that he's going to recover from that. That's really very sad indeed, because you need to have a good leader of the third party, and they haven't got one.
Martin?
Oh, I think he'll recover all right. I think he's doing quite well. If you look in the polls, the Lib Dems have been on the up since he became leader. I don't think this is anything more than a storm in a teacup. And I think that Clegg is a pretty good leader of the Liberal Democrats. And in some ways, the Liberal Democrats are the most interesting party in British politics at the moment, because they're the ones that will shape the result of the next general election.
Yes, we've all got our EU flags here and are singing along to the Union's unofficial anthem. As all EU anoraks know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Ode to Joy, is sung before breakfast by all true Eurocrats. But you have to be a really sad anorak to know that the EU has no official anthem. That may sound mind-numbingly techie, but it actually goes to the heart of this week's row. Ode to Joy was the official anthem in the old EU constitution, but there is no such thing in the new treaty because it has been stripped of the trappings of a state. Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg are using that watering down to say there should be no referendum on the treaty, but the Lib Dems want a separate in-or-out referendum on Britain's membership of the EU, and so they abstained in that Commons vote on whether to have a poll on the treaty. That left Clegg vulnerable to taunts in the Commons.
Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister once said that he would, and I quote, build a wider pro-European movement in Britain. How does he think he's going to achieve that? By colluding with the anti-European Conservatives to block the in-out referendum that the British people really want?
Mr Speaker, by not walking out of the House of Commons for a start, by not saying that there is a principle in abstention when it comes to a European issue. And I tell him we will lead the agenda about the future of Europe, we will lead on the environment, we will lead on international development, we will lead on the approach to globalisation, and we will lead on security. There is not much principle, Mr Speaker, in recommending abstention.
That was Gordon Brown. Charles, you were saying earlier that you think that Nick Clegg has been damaged by this one and that leaders of parties need to have a clear line. But his problem is that his party's divided, and that's tricky, isn't it?
I don't know how divided his party really is. I mean, the central issue is on the European Union itself and what you think about the treaty. There is a separate set of questions about how this country should decide about the treaties of this kind, what its relationship is to the European Union, particularly whether there should be a referendum. But I don't think his party is that deeply divided on the issues of substance. The reason why I disagree with what Martin said earlier, though I do agree that it is something of a storm in a teacup, is that judgment is the thing upon which leaders are judged by the people who have to vote for them. And this is an early moment of poor judgment by Nick Clegg, which I think will reverberate, even though the issue itself is not of a great deal of substance.
Martin, rally to the fence of Nick Clegg.
Well, I think he inherited a completely broken-back policy on the referendum from both Charles Kennedy and Ming Campbell, who got themselves into this as a way of trying to get some MPs in the southwest off the hook on the issue. But, I mean, at the end of the day, the European cause in this country has faltered very often precisely because leaders of parties, leaders of governments, have found it very difficult to take a lead and to push that line through and to take a clear pro-European stance. I'm not saying Clegg took a perfectly clear stance on this question because of the referendum tangle, but he is pro-European. He is unequivocally so on the big issue, and that's not true of either of the other political party leaders in this country. So in that sense, I'm proud of him for having taken the stance that he did.
Jenny, Martin is proud of Nick Clegg, but you were saying this is not his finest hour. But do you think that what some critics say of Nick Clegg is that one of his weaknesses is he gets quite passionate, and he's obviously passionately pro-European, and perhaps he didn't make the cool judgment that good leaders need to make?
I think, unfortunately, he came across yesterday as passionately querulous, which is no good at all. As Michael Ancram said, he appeared to be boldly leading the Lib Dems towards a fence on which they would sit. Nobody who watched the performance last night could have had a clear sense of what the Lib Dem policy on Europe was. They may be fundamentally for it, but that's not what you understood from their policy yesterday. And the reason that I think it matters is not because the issue itself yesterday was particularly significant. It didn't actually matter very much what decision the Lib Dems took, but it does expose the fact that, as Charles says, Clegg doesn't have judgment. And he also doesn't know how to recover from a mistake. He just looked very weak yesterday, and that's what will last.
Charles, sorry.
Could I just make one further point? Because Martin made an important point, and I think quite a true point, on which Jenny's remark relates. And Martin's point was that the attitude of the Lib Dems in and around the next general election, after the next general election, about the future of government in Britain, in particular whether they would sustain Labour in office if we didn't have an overall majority, or whether they'd go with the Conservatives in those circumstances, is a very big and very interesting question. But the key matter will be judgment, exactly the issue that Jenny's just described. And I think that when you look at the judgments, and that is the right word to use, that will have to be made in such circumstances, Nick Clegg's performance yesterday doesn't give rise to confidence.
It should have been Hewn for Leader.
In my opinion, yes. If I'd been Lib Dem, I'd have definitely voted for Hewn. I think Hewn's got a much clearer sense of direction about what he's about.
Now, it felt a bit like the 1990s this week when we watched MPs from all parties rebel on Europe. The scenes in the Commons once again raised the question about whether Britain will ever have a settled view about the European Union. Charles, you're a big pro-European. Do you think that this week's events show that all leaders will always be bugged by Europe?
I think two things about it. Firstly, I think we have to get through this immediate process of ratifying the Lisbon Treaty to be able to get into a sensible discussion about it. And that's very important in the context that Martin said earlier, that Nick Clegg probably is the clearest pro-European of the leaders, is a very significant thing from that point of view. And then we have to decide what is the country's agenda for the future vis-a-vis the European Union, what's the European Union's agenda for itself. Now, I think that on both questions, there's a lot of lack of clarity. If you look at the Western Balkans, for example, and how we enlarge the Western Balkans and deal with serious organised crime and so on there, that's a major question. If you look at the environmental questions, a lot of issues. But we haven't yet, and it's a fair criticism that Martin can make, got a clear direction. But now is the time to move to that clear direction.
Now, Martin, you occasionally wrote the odd favourable article about Tony Blair. Tony Blair's great mission was to reconcile Britain's position within the European Union. He utterly failed on that, didn't he?
I think utterly is a word I would almost utterly avoid in political discussion. I never think it's very helpful to say that everything is conclusive. Everything always stays open in one way or another. Blair, I think that, you know, Blair was a disappointment on Europe because, I mean, he himself was committed to Britain in Europe, but I don't think he went the right way about it. And at the end, in the end, he couldn't deliver. And this is the problem for all political parties on this question. You know, as long as we have the vicious circle of anti-Europeanism within our political discussions, it's really difficult to break out of it. And that's something which, you know, I mean, it's not just a matter of bravery that's involved in breaking out of it one of these days. It's also a matter of raw cunning. You know, somebody like Charles, I think, would be in a very good position to do that if he was in government again, you know, after the process of ratification has gone through. But I would just say, you know, this one thing about Britain and Europe, it's clear from opinion polls that people in this country do actually want Europe to do things. There is an agenda that people in this country want Europe to deliver on. It's mainly to do with terrorism and climate change, but it's also on other things. And so, you know, there is an opening, there is an opportunity here for British politicians with a bit of backbone and with a bit of strategic sense of where Britain's long-term interests lie, which in my opinion is clearly within the framework of a reformed European Union.
Jenny, Martin is saying that people in Britain want Europe to work for them, and it was interesting that Charles was saying that the Western Balkans is really important, that's being stabilised by the European Union, which is in Britain's interests. Do you think that our leaders are not very good at making the case in that sort of way that the European Union actually is quite a good thing?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one thing that always strikes me when we have this kind of discussion is the complete disconnect between people who are knowledgeable about what's going on in Europe and what membership of the European Union means and the total lack of interest amongst ordinary people or understanding or knowledge about it. We talk here about the Lib Dems being clearly the most pro-European party, but out on the streets that doesn't really mean very much. People have a whole lot of prejudices in their heads about EU regulations and about how they constrain the freedom of action of governments. They don't understand the implications of what's planned for Europe in the future. They don't know very much about the implications, for instance, of the idea that Turkey may join the European Union. No one's explaining to them that on the one hand, the good thing about that is that you may end up with a more secular Turkey that's more interested in human rights because it wants to join the European Union and may make the world a safer place. But on the other hand, you may end up with a great many Turkish people coming to work in this country. Now, those are the kinds of issues which are really going to matter to people, and actually nobody's going out there and talking about it.
Charles, Martin was saying that Tony Blair was a disappointment on Europe, but not an utter disappointment on Europe. How do you think Gordon Brown's handled it? There was quite a lot of criticism in Brussels that there was macho language in the negotiations over the Lisbon Treaty, and then there was the turning up or not turning up for the signing ceremony in December.
Well, firstly, I agree with Martin about Tony. I wrote this piece about a year ago saying that I thought he had been a major disappointment in this, and it is a striking thing that he was deeply ambitious to put Britain at the heart of Europe. He was very pro-EU, but at the end of the day, pulled back when the key choices had to be made, and so ended up certainly not nearer the heart of Europe than when we started. Gordon is less instinctively in that direction, certainly he didn't favour the euro, which Tony Blair did. I've spoken to him about this. He says he remains very much pro-European and wants to work in that context. The ridiculous farce of the EU signing ceremony, the treaty signing ceremony, was absurd and weakened his position immensely. I remain optimistic that once we're through the ratification of the Lisbon Treaty, it will be possible for Gordon to play a role to establish a more pro-European direction, which I also think is very important in the international framework. For example, the Middle East, Iran, the Near East generally, where a stronger pro-European voice will make American intervention less necessary in certain circumstances, and I think it would be a very good thing in that area. But I would have to concede when talking about Gordon's role that there's a way to go before I'd be completely convinced that he was in the place that I think he should be.
But do you think that Tony Blair being a disappointment and Gordon Brown not quite being there yet, does that show problems with those two leaders, or does it show that in this country, whoever you are, if you have good intentions on Europe, it just won't happen both. Because of the political reality?
It shows both. I mean, Jenny was right when she talked about backbone and leadership. It would have been entirely possible in 97, 98, 99 to have a completely different position if Labour had been less frightened of the next election, less frightened of the Murdoch press, had more determination to go for it. And that's what we should have done. So there are personal questions. But there is a much more general political environment which is very difficult to handle. But that requires, as everybody was saying, making the argument and getting out there.
Martin.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it has to be said that by comparison with the Conservative Party, at least Gordon Brown is by and large saying roughly the right things. And the other very important thing here is that Gordon Brown doesn't have a Gordon Brown conspiring against him on every single issue. And there's no question that had we had this vote that we've had this week when Tony Blair was Prime Minister, we would have had Brown scheming around, holding back his cards, his troops, and generally making it very difficult for the government. Gordon Brown has a free hand in the party. He doesn't have someone conspiring against him of any importance anyway. And I think that he's therefore, you know, in a position to really put his foot on the accelerator should he choose to. And it's a big choice for him.
Jenny, did you want to come in?
Well, I just thought that was fascinating because that's probably right, in which case what on earth is stopping the man? Freedom of choice, leading a party, huge majority, no one conspiring against him. There's no reason not to get out there and say what he believes in. But that's one of the criticisms we've made about Brown on many issues.
Well, we'll put away our EU anoraks now and turn to matters closer to home and look at how Gordon Brown's government is doing. Our guest of honour today, Charles Clark, has a historic place in the Labour Party. He played a key role in putting a young Tony Blair on the front bench back in 1984. As Chief of Staff to Neil Kinnock, Charles telephoned Blair to ask him to come and see his leader, who made him a Treasury spokesman. Charles went on to become Home Secretary, but he's now on the Labour backbenches. But he has strong views about what this government should be doing. Charles, you recently had a pop at Gordon Brown in the Daily Mail. Are things picking up?
Well, the key thing is, what are we going to do to win the next election and make sure we take the position strongly forward? I identify three issues which are particularly important. The first we've just been talking about, a strongly pro-EU position, carrying things through very much in that way. The second is a strong green and sustainable focus as to where we are, on which I'm rather disappointed at the moment. I think the announcement on national road pricing, for example, was disappointing earlier this week. And I don't think it's obvious that the government at the moment is seizing the green agenda in the way it needs to. And I find it embarrassing, actually.
Excuse me, Charles, they are. Gordon Brown is backing a tax on plastic bags.
Well, I was delighted to see that, Jenny. And unfortunately, as I think you intended by that intervention, that just simply illustrates the point. Yeah. The fact is, if you look at the European Commission white papers on these areas, on energy, for example, generation of renewables, we are in an absolutely pathetic position compared to many other countries, and we need to do far more. So that area is not being fulfilled. The third area, public service reform, remains a very tough question. And Gordon at the moment is talking very much as though he believes the reform agenda that was carried through is the right thing to do. And that's being manifested in various areas. So I'd have to say the jury's out in a number of these areas. I have been critical, and I remain critical in an important sense, that we have to have a clear direction on these things, and I don't think we have.
On that issue of public service reform, indeed the reform agenda as a whole, there was some feeling that last year, in his first 6 months as Prime Minister, he was not exactly pursuing what you might call a Blairite agenda. And then James Purnell was made Work and Pension Secretary. James Purnell, who worked for Tony Blair, has a smile on his face, and he says that he is now being able to implement reforms like the David Freud reform on welfare reform that a year ago was being trashed by the Treasury. Do you see a change there?
I think there is a change. I think after the period before Christmas, where there was serious criticism of Gordon's leadership, over Christmas he thought very hard about what to do, made certain organisational changes at the centre of No. 10 Downing Street in the Cabinet Office to work more effectively, and I gather from the discussions in the Cabinet has much more strongly signed up to that reform agenda, including the welfare area, as you mentioned. So he's reflected on what has happened and is trying to change to take that forward.
Is he still a ditherer?
It depends on the issue. I think he is not decisive enough in too many areas. I remain of that view, but we'll have to see, really. I mean, it depends on the issue. He's certainly taken steps to try and get a more efficient decision-taking process in government, which will work more quickly. Now, we'll have to see whether that actually carries through in the way it needs to.
Jenny, you were impressed on by Gordon Brown, obviously, supporting that Daily Mail campaign on banning the plastic bags. Rally to the defence of the Prime Minister, please.
Oh, I think his position on the environment is absolutely untenable. He was the person who commissioned the Stern report. And then this is a government which is backing the expansion of Heathrow, has withdrawn from road pricing, has just got no coherent policy at all.
Martin Kettle, is there anyone here who's going to make the case for Gordon Brown?
Well, I rather admire Gordon Brown, watched him a long time, and he's a superbly well-versed politician in so many issues. I think the question for Gordon Brown is prioritising. I mean, you know, his priority must be to select carefully the kind of issues, perhaps the ones which Charles Clarke's just mentioned earlier, that will identify Labour distinctly from the other parties. At the moment, I suspect the government isn't really going to do that, though. And, you know, I'm rather sceptical because it seems to me, really, that the government is looking now at a general election in the spring of 2009, and therefore mentally it's almost into a pre-election mode, and therefore I don't think it's going to be doing anything very dramatic, and it's just sort of hoping that things will incrementally get a little bit better month by month as they arguably are doing, at least they're not getting incrementally worse, and that somehow or other along the road the Conservatives will stumble, that David Cameron will have more problems, and that somehow or other Labour will come back with a small majority, small but workable majority, at which point some great Brownite vision for Britain may or may not be unveiled for us.
We're just in fantasy land here. I know there's a newspaper piece today, this week, saying that Gordon was looking at a May 2009 election. I don't believe it for a moment. The election will be in May or June 2010, because as you get closer to May 2009, the prospect of being certain of winning will recede, and so the election will be delayed. Far better to say now the election's going to be in May, June 2010, exactly what John Major did, and perfectly reasonable thing to say, and say, OK, let's use that two and a half years to elaborate the policies that we're going to carry through. The danger, and I think you describe it accurately, of floating the idea of a spring 2009 election is it just closes everything down and we just kind of stumble along. And people completely underestimate the fact that to win the next general election, in the sense of Labour having an overall majority, we've got to avoid losing about 24 to 28 seats on the new boundaries, of which the overwhelming majority are in the Evening Standard readership range, the southeast of England, North Kent, and so on, where we haven't yet got a clear appeal and direction to say what we're going to do. So if you turn out to be right in what you said, it will be a disaster because we'll stumble along, not change very much, then get hammered.
Well, I just wanted to make clear that's not my personal view.
No, of course.
What I think is going on in government from talking to people, as obviously you do too, Charles, and Jenny does as well.
Jenny, you're keen to get a word in.
I think what's alarming about this is that I don't think the electorate so much want to know what Labour stands for. I think they want them to be doing things now. And I think that for most people, it's now very unclear what the key differences are between the Tories and Labour. And I think that's disastrous. I've been talking to a lot of teenagers recently. I have some of my own. And when they start asking what the differences are between the parties, you find yourself absolutely floundering. You fall back on what parties used to stand for and what you believe their core beliefs used to be. But actually, when you start explaining policies, whether it's on getting the unemployed back to work, where Labour and the Tories are now absolutely merging, or on hospitals, or on so many issues, you can no longer draw clear lines that anybody understands. And what people want to see are improvements in their daily lives. And they're very disillusioned, a lot of the people that I talk to who aren't in the chattering classes, about what's actually happening on the ground with things like dentistry, post offices, hospitals, and they are not convinced that Labour is delivering the better quality of life, putting individuals at the heart of their policies in the way that they believed they were going to do. And I think that's the real danger.
So, Charles, Jenny's saying that people don't think there's a difference between the parties. Now, there's one area where there is a difference, ID cards. Jackie Smith is today making an announcement on the rolling out of that. Is the government doing well on that one?
I think it's doing the right thing. I know it's a very controversial policy and there are many people who don't agree, including, I suspect, some other people around the table now. But I myself think it's the right thing to do, and I'm glad that the government's going ahead with it. I think protecting individual identities against fraud and theft is a very important thing and is already being done in a vast number of different ways which don't involve ID cards at all, both privately and by public organisations. And so I think she's right to press ahead.
Martin.
I mean, I'm instinctively against ID cards, but I mean, there is obviously a case for them, and it can be made well. The problem with ID cards is whether the system works. And, you know, the government and the state, it's not just the Labour government, but the state's reputation as an efficient deliverer of that kind of system is so threadbare at the moment, for all the reasons that we're all very familiar with, that I'm just very, very sceptical about it. I mean, I think it's one of those issues that makes people say, oh, that, you know, the government is just floundering, trying to produce instant solutions to problems that it isn't quite competent to deliver on.
Jenny, I imagine you're not lining up to sign up for the ID cards.
No, Charles and I have had deep quarrels about this in the past. I disagree with both Charles and Martin on this. I don't think the issue is whether or not they work. I think the whole point is that they are a solution in search of a problem. I mean, as Charles says, you can establish your identity already in many ways. There's absolutely no evidence that ID cards would do anything to stop terrorism. And the whole thing is going to be an enormous expansion of state power and collecting of information. And the issue is not the carrying of cards. I think that's the great misunderstanding here. I don't think many people would object if we were carrying around something which was the equivalent of almost a library card or a driving license that said who you were. The issue is the connection to the national database and the accumulation of information about individuals. And the purpose of that is going to be to spot anything which politicians or civil servants or administrators perceive as deviance. We're all going to start wondering about whether we're going to be picked out on computer programs as somebody who has worrying characteristics.
OK, thanks for that. Before we go, one last question to Charles. Charles, you mentioned a general election coming up. David Cameron, big threat to the Labour Party?
Not as big as people think. He's a good debater. He's charming. He's fluent. He appears convincing. But as we going back to where this whole discussion started, you need, if you're a leader, to have all those things, but also clarity, judgment and direction. And I'm not at all convinced he has. More seriously, I'm not convinced he has his party behind him. At least David Cameron understands that he needs to be competing from the centre of British politics rather than from the ultra-right, as his predecessors did on many of these issues. But a lot of his party don't agree, and I'm not sure in his own core that David Cameron agrees. So I don't think he's such a dangerous threat as some people think.
Well, that's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the former Home Secretary Charles Clarke and the Guardian columnist Jenny Russell and Martin Kettle. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Till then, goodbye.
Politics Weekly with Nick Watt on guardian.co.uk.